Okay. Just kidding.
Okay, so good morning. Nice to be back here. I was looking in my files, and it turns out that my computer remembers, and I also remember a little bit hazily, that I was here just a year ago talking about Hanukkah, the upcoming Jewish holiday, which means I have to say something different, assuming that someone remembers what we talked about last time. So what I want to do is I want to take a different look at Hanukkah. I want to first tell the story that I told last year to condense it into 5 minutes, and then tell a different story about the same holiday. In other words, I want to look at the same holiday from a different perspective, which perhaps will be a little bit interesting, I hope. So Hanukkah is a Jewish holiday coming up in another week. It's an 8-day celebration. I won't say of what yet. An 8-day celebration in which Jews around the world light a candle every night. One candle the first night, second candle, two candles the second, and then three and four and five until you get to the 8th day, we have 8 candles lit. That means the 8th night, we're lighting 8 candles. It's a minor holiday. It's not mentioned in the Jewish Bible. It's not in Scripture. It doesn't have any of the force and power of the biblical holidays. It's not like Passover. It's not like Shavuot, Pentecost. It's not like a holiday of Sukkot, Tabernacles. It doesn't have the biblical force. There's no prohibition of doing labor like there is on the biblical holidays. It's rather a minor holiday in America because it comes at the same time as Christmas. It's been commercialized and it's become popular. But the truth is, in Israel, people go to work. It's not like...
In fact, there isn't a scripture in the New Testament that talks about Hanukkah.
Half a verse.
Yeah, half
in John.
Here.
Right. Look at that. And blue and white candles for the flag of the state of Israel. So you see there's 8 places for the candles there, and there's a 9th. The 9th is higher because it's the helping candle. It's just used to light the others. It's really 8 candles for 8 nights. So what are we celebrating? So to make a long story short, again, I'm repeating things that I said last time. In about the year 167 before the Common Era, over 2,000 years ago, the small Jewish population of Jerusalem and Judah, basically where Jerusalem and its environs is today, succeeded in throwing off Greek rule and establishing an independent commonwealth. That's what we're celebrating. The revolt against the Greek overlords and the success of the Jewish revolution, the Jewish effort to gain independence. That is the story, and to add to it a little bit, when the Maccabees, that's the family that led the revolt, when the Maccabees recaptured the center of Jerusalem from the Greek army and came back to the temple there, that was partially destroyed and certainly defiled, they came back to the temple, they wanted to reinstate the daily temple service, the sacrificial service there, and part of the service in the temple is the lighting of the candelabra every single day. And that had to be lit with special oil that was pure, and they didn't find any of the special oil. They found one little cruse is an English word, right? Mm. One little can of oil that was sealed, that saying was still pure. They lit it for that day, and miraculously, it lit for 8 days until they were able to get more oil. That's the folklore behind the idea of the way it's celebrated for not just one day, but for 8 days. Last time we talked about the fact that there's actually more behind it. Leave all that out. So that's the simple story. What I want to do now is look at the deeper political and religious machinations going on behind the scenes, and perhaps by doing that, we'll be able to understand something of the contemporary relevance of the ideas of the holiday. Okay. So, it's about politics, and it gets to be a little bit complicated. So here we are, about in the second century before the Common Era. Like I said, the Jews who live in Judea and in Jerusalem are under the finger of the Greek Seleucids. You can see I put major terms and concepts right at the beginning. The Greek Empire, in the wake of Alexander of Macedonia, Alexander the Great, has conquered the whole Western world as we know it, the whole world as we know it. And Hellenism, which means Greek culture, the universalistic powerful, strong culture that was the world cosmopolitan culture is encroaching on the land of Israel as well. And Jews are assimilating, accepting, adopting the cosmopolitan culture. You have a situation not too similar, not too different than what you have in America today. There is a culture, a basically universalist culture, American culture, that has basically conquered the world. And around the world, whether it's in China, whether it's in America, whether it's in Europe, whether it's McDonald's or the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal, with consumerism, someone's drilling.
Yeah.
Drilling into the vault in the bank. That culture conquers the world. And local cultures, whether they're Jewish or whatever it might be, local cultures seem to be backward, primitive, and they are being gobbled up by the larger culture. Assimilation to the prevailing culture. What do you do under the circumstances? How does the traditional culture react? How does it navigate itself? That's really what was going on in the years leading up to Hanukkah, the first Hanukkah. We're going to read now from the books of the Maccabees. Now, it's a very interesting thing. There are four books called the books of the Maccabees. 1, 2, 3, and 4. The 3 and 4, they're philosophical works that don't concern us.
Can I make a comment, Perry? This, by the way, is not accepted. It's not canonized by us, right, as from what our faith is. All right. Now, I don't know if you know that or not.
I was about to say something about that.
Yeah.
All right.
Okay.
Right. Actually, I brought here
the
New Oxford Annotated Bible with Apocrypha. It's not a Jewish collection, and you say it's not a Protestant collection, but in the Catholic Church, these books of the Maccabees are part of the canon. So we're going to be studying for the next 40 minutes books that are not within the Jewish tradition and not within the Protestant tradition. But these, like I said, the last two books of the Maccabees are philosophical, they don't concern us. The first two books are historical. They're two different historical accounts of the events that happened at this time. And these books didn't make it into the Jewish canon. Not only didn't they make it into the Jewish canon, they were basically lost to the Jewish people. When we have them today, they're not in the original Hebrew language. They've been translated into Greek and then into Coptic, and now we have them in English. When you read it in Hebrew, it's translated from the translation of the translation.
Do you accept it then as inspired by God?
No.
No. Same as us.
But it's history.
Yeah, history.
It's very important, interesting stuff there.
Okay.
Everything we know at Hanukkah comes from these books that were written by Jews, for Jews, about Jews, but they didn't become part of the Jewish tradition, and they were lost basically to the Jewish people, and they've been re-recovered from the Catholic Church.
These were assimilated Jews that wrote it.
Well, we're about to see. You'll see the viewpoint of the writers as we read the material.
Okay. Right.
Let's now read carefully from the second book of the Maccabees, chapter 4. These are two different books again, two different accounts of the same events.
Okay.
I'll read and then we'll explain afterwards. When Jason received the king's approval and came into office, he immediately initiated his compatriots into the Greek way of life. He set aside the royal concessions granted to the Jews through the mediation of John. I'm skipping two lines. Mm-hmm. He set aside the Torah practices and introduced customs contrary to the Torah. With perverse delight, he established a gymnasium at the very foot of the citadel, where he induced the noblest young men to wear the Greek hat. The craze for Hellenism and the adoption of foreign customs reached such a pitch, through the outrageous wickedness of Jason, the renegade and would-be high priest, that the priests no longer cared about the service of the altar. Disdaining the temple and neglecting the sacrifices, they hastened at the signal for the games to take part in the unlawful exercises at the arena. What their ancestors had regarded as honors, they despised. What the Greeks esteemed as glory, they prized highly. So this is a story written, apparently by a traditional Jew, who was very, very critical of the behavior of the aristocracy, of the upper classes.
Mm-hmm.
So at the center of Jewish life was the temple. The head of the temple was the high priest. The high priest is supposed to be from a certain family, from the children and descendants of Aaron the high priest, going back to the Bible. And his descendants in every generation, they're the priests, and the one who's at the highest level should be the high priest. But in the time that we're talking about, the high priesthood was sold by the Greek overlords to the highest bidder. And anyone who wanted to be high priest, all he had to do was give enough money into the Greek treasury, and he got the honor. And you have these Hellenized, that means to say assimilated Jews, vying for the honor of being the high priest by paying tribute to the royal coffers. Now there's mention here of the royal concessions granted to the Jews. What that means is that the Greek king, Antiochus his name was, had agreed that the Jews live according to their ancestral customs. Those are the concessions. But Jason, this newly appointed high priest who got his job by paying for it, he wants to abolish the concessions. He doesn't want the Greek government to allow the Jews to live according to their law. He wants to force his fellow Jews to take upon themselves the new cosmopolitan, universal, postmodern way of living, because that's the better way to do things.
Sounds like Tel Aviv.
Sounds like, okay, you said it, I didn't. Right? So, it's not the Greeks against the Jews. It's the Jews against the Jews. We're talking about the development of real, serious, internal, civil, and religious conflict. It's not just the Jews against the Greeks. It's the Greeks and the Greek Jews against the, you could say, old-fashioned, traditional, backward Jews who are trying to keep their religions. And the conflict really is brewing here. And in the aristocracy, and now Jason, the head of the whole thing, he's trying to convince, sometimes by words, sometimes by force, he's trying to convince the backward Jews to accept these practices of the aristocracy. The gymnasium, of course, we know that they participated there in the athletic games in the nude, and it's right there by the temple. The traditional Jews see it as an affront to everything that Torah stands for. Okay, and he is causing the other priests to neglect the sacrifices in the temple, and again we have this developing conflict. Now let's go to the first book of the Maccabees, a different account of the same events, just where we left off. In those days, there appeared in Israel transgressors of the Torah who seduced many, saying, "Let us go and make a covenant with the Gentiles all around us. Since we separated from them, many evils have come upon us." Right? The Jews trying to live separate with their separate laws, but now the suggestion is, let's go join them. Let's acculturate and assimilate. Life will be better for us because we'll join the developing world economy. Right? It's very similar to what we have today. The proposal was agreeable to them. Some from among the people promptly went to the king, and he authorized them to introduce the ordinances of the Gentiles. Now the Jews are going to the Greek king and saying, "Help us to Hellenize our fellow brethren." Thereupon they built a gymnasium in Jerusalem according to the Gentile custom, as we just read. They undid their circumcision. So you have all these Jewish aspiring athletes who are circumcised, and in the gymnasiums, the games are in the nude, and they are surgically undoing their circumcision so they won't look Jewish.
Like the health clubs.
This is all in the nude. No shirts and t-shirts. And you can imagine the effort that they're going to undo their circumcision. That's not a simple process. They undid their circumcision, abandoned the Holy Covenant, they allied themselves with the Gentiles and gave themselves over to wrongdoing. So obviously, John, this is written from the point of view of a traditional Jew. And it's not written by a Hellenizer. Mm-hmm. If they had won the war, they would have written it differently, obviously.
Yeah.
If the victors write history. Then the king wrote to his whole kingdom that all should be one people and abandon their particular customs. In other words, at this point, the king Antiochus sees that this conflict is developing between the traditional Jews and the Hellenizing Jews, and he sees his opportunity now to go one step further and encourage the whole Jewish population to Hellenize, so he makes it a matter of law. Not just that the Jews are suggesting and trying to bring their backward brethren into the modern culture, but now the Greek king is actually putting this into law and decree. All the Gentiles conformed to the command of the king, and many Israelites delighted in his religion, the idolatry of Greece. They sacrificed to idols and profaned the Sabbath. Many of the people, those who abandoned the Torah, joined them and committed evil in the land. And now it's a matter of law that you're not allowed to practice the Torah, you're not allowed to circumcise. They drove Israel into hiding wherever places of refuge could be found. So those traditional Jews who are not willing to give up their religion are forced to go into hiding. They become secret Jews, as it were, in their own land, going into the forests and going into the hills. Whoever was found with the scroll of the covenant and whoever observed the Torah was condemned to death by royal decree.
Sounds like Spain, doesn't it?
It does. So they used their power against Israel, against those who were caught each month in the cities. In keeping with the decree, they put to death women who had their children circumcised, and they hung their babies from their necks, their families also, and those who had circumcised them were killed. But many in Israel were determined and resolved in their hearts not to eat anything unclean, not to eat anything unkosher. They preferred to die rather than to be defiled with food or to profane the holy covenant, and they did die.
This sounds like Daniel.
Very great wrath came upon Israel. So we have, let's talk about three different camps here. There are the Greeks, and then there are the Hellenized Jews, and then we have the traditional Jews, and these traditional Jews until now have been described as martyrs. They're willing to give up their lives for the Torah and for their ancestral beliefs. We have not seen anything yet about Jews who are willing to fight back. It's now about passively submitting to the decree, that's God's will, I'll give up my life for the truth.
And this was after the king's decree that you must follow the Greek.
Yeah,
okay.
Right.
So these are the hardcore people, hardcore Jews that post the king's. It's not just them reacting to their fellow Jews.
Right, it looks like the king was emboldened by the Hellenizers to enact these decrees.
Law. Okay.
And then every Jew has to make a decision. Right? Is he going to go over to the Hellenizer and accept the new religion, the new culture, the new way of doing things? Or is he going to risk his life to maintain the ancient ways? First book of the Maccabees, chapter 2. Now this part we have to read, I brought last year. It's the famous section, the most famous section. But we're going to look at something a little bit deeper here. As he finished saying these words, we're talking here about a Greek official that comes into the town of Modi'in and announces the king's decree. Everyone has to give up Judaism, give up the Torah. Everyone's invited to come here to the altar, to Zeus, and sacrifice a pig.
And By the way, that town exists today, doesn't it?
Still does, right by the airport, right?
Yeah. We're driving.
Mm-hmm. And actually, right by there.
Seeing an exit on the way to Jerusalem.
Right, yeah?
Yeah.
And right by there, there's a national park that's called the Graves of the Maccabees. Kivrei HaMaccabim.
You've been there, Martin?
No.
It's graves, you know.
Yes.
Not like there's great things to see.
Yeah.
As he finished saying these words, that is the Greek official who came to convert, as it were, all the Jews to Hellenism, a certain Jew came forward in the sight of all to sacrifice on the altar in Modi'in according to the king's order. Right? To show, I'm with the king. When Matthias, we call him in Hebrew Matityahu, saw him, he was filled with zeal, his heart was moved, and his just fear was aroused. He sprang forward and killed him upon the altar. Jew killed Jew. Got that?
Okay.
This is civil war. At the same time, he also killed the messenger of the king. That's Jew kills Greek. Who was forcing the sacrifice, and he tore down the altar. Then, thus he showed zeal for the Torah, just as Pinchas did with Zimri, son of Salu. So that's a reference to the book of Numbers.
Mm-hmm.
When we have this revolt against God that had to do with idolatry and sexual licentiousness, and one of the Jews got up and said, too much, and he killed a Jew who was involved in idolatry and sexual licentiousness. Mm-hmm. So this now is fighting back. It's the first time we've seen mention of that in the book of Maccabees, which means we're talking not about one or two camps of Jews, we're talking about three. They're the Jews who Hellenize, they're the Jews who resist passively, and there's the Jews that resist actively. Those are three different ideologies of how to live your life. Very different. And it's very possible that even after Matityahu created the revolt and said, we're going to take up the sword to defend Judaism, we're not going to go like sheep to the slaughter, there were many Jews who said, no, you have to accept God's decree. If God decreed that the Greeks are trying to kill us, then it must be we've sinned. Must be we did something wrong. We have to accept the decree and give our lives for God. Don't give in. Don't eat pork. Don't sacrifice on the altar. But also don't resist. because it's God's will. Whereas Matityahu says there's a third way, not the Hellenizing way, not the pacifist way of giving in to the decree, as it were, but taking up the sword and saying, whoever is with God, with me, and we'll fight back. Three different religious ideologies. Then he and his sons fled to the mountains, leaving behind in the city all their possessions. At the time, those who sought righteousness and justice went out into the wilderness to settle there. They and their children, their wives, and their animals, because misfortune pressed them so hard. Now listen to this. It was reported to the officers and soldiers of the king who were in the city of David in Jerusalem that those who had flouted the king's order had gone into secret refuges in the wilderness. Many hurried out after them, and having caught up with them, camped opposite and prepared to attack them on the Sabbath. So it looks like you have an army, kind of a guerrilla army, perhaps made up of some of the king's soldiers and made up of some Jews as well, coming to attack those Jews that had fled to the wilderness in order to keep their religion. And they're preparing to attack them on the Sabbath, which probably means it's not the Sabbath yet. But they're preparing to attack them on the Sabbath. And why on the Sabbath? Because the Jews are not going to resist. They're going to go to sleep sheep to the slaughter. The pursuers said to them, enough of this. Come out and obey the king's command, and you will live. If you come out, obey, accept the new religion, everything will be fine. But they replied, we will not come out, nor will we obey the king's command to profane the Sabbath. Then the enemy attacked them at once, but they did not retaliate. They neither threw stones nor blocked up their secret refuge. They said, let us all die in innocence. Heaven and earth are our witnesses that you destroy us unjustly. So the officers and soldiers attacked them on the Sabbath, and they died with their wives, their children, their animals, to a number of 1,000 persons. Let's just think about this a minute. This encampment is in the wilderness trying to hide, to keep their religion as they believe they should be doing. They hear that the Greek army, the regulars and irregulars, Jews perhaps as well as the Greeks, are coming to attack them. And even though it's not Sabbath yet, they still don't flee. Why didn't they flee when they heard that the Greeks were coming? It looks like it's not merely that they're not going to defend themselves on the Sabbath, they're also not going to defend themselves on Friday or Thursday or Wednesday. Just like we read earlier, they believe it's God's will, we're going to accept what's happening. And all the more so on the Sabbath, we're not even going to build up rocks to enclose our caves. We're going to let them come in because we're not going to profane the Sabbath even to save our own lives. A very, very pacifist ideology that's, by the way, based on the book of Jeremiah, certain readings are like, boy, here, we're not going to look at it. That you have to accept the will of God. Whatever happens, that must be what God wants. And if we're being persecuted, it must be for our sins. But Matityahu has none of that. He won't accept that ideology. And then we continue reading in verse 39. Then Matityahu and his friends heard of it. They mourned deeply for them. They said to one another, if we all do as our kindred have done, and do not fight against the Gentiles for our lives and our laws, they will soon destroy us from the earth. And they decide that it's permitted, it's even laudable, to kill in order not to be killed, to defend themselves, and even more than that, to kill in order to prevent these religious decrees from being put into application. They're not just going to go like sheep to the slaughter. And then they go one step further. So that on that day, they came to this decision. Let us fight against anyone who attacks us on the Sabbath, so that we may not all die as our kindred died in their secret refuges. That's a religious decision of prioritizing. Yes, it says in the Torah you shouldn't break the Sabbath. But they're saying, if we don't break the Sabbath, allow ourselves to be killed, there'll be no Jews left. So we have to decide that we think it might be, it could be God's will that we break the Sabbath to save our lives. So we'll be around the next week, and the next year, and the next 100 years, the next 1,000 years to keep further Sabbaths. It's a religious decision based on more than just a fundamentalist reading of one verse, keep the Sabbath. It's looking at a broad picture and says, wait a second, there are other values involved here. Saving our lives for the sake of the future, may be a higher value than keeping the Sabbath, and we're going to make a religious decision without a prophet telling us. We're going to make a religious decision that God wants us to break the Sabbath. That is a very important religious move.
One point. We did this. When we brought the Turks there to drill AME, there was a decision made. We went to the rabbi, to you, I think, at that time, and also in Israel. Was it you or Rabbi Zakai?
I don't think so. Not me.
I'm not too sure.
We had an issue because the drilling people said that they had to drill on Shabbat. And we said, no, we don't drill on Shabbat because Lapidot didn't. All right, we've never done that. Mm-hmm. And we said, no, we won't break Shabbat. They said, in this case, there's life at risk, and we can get an absolution, which that's the only word I know how to use, mm-hmm. from the priests, uh-huh. from the rabbis, uh-huh. Uh-huh. You know, saying that in this case, if we can prove that it would put people in harm's way to be mm-hmm. killed by drilling, mm-hmm. they would grant us the permission to drill mm-hmm. in Shabbat. Mm-hmm. That's what we did. We went to the rabbis, and they gave it to us in writing. The only way we would do it, I wouldn't do it.
Because stopping and starting
it
is dangerous?
Well, it had something to do with where we're drilling in this area, that there was some real concern that if they stopped drilling and just circulated on that day, uh-huh. it could blow up or whatever.
I see.
I've never heard that before because on the previous wells, we never had that discussion. Mm-hmm. This time it was mm-hmm. like, they're from Turkey, not because they were Gentiles, and we're going to break the Shabbat anyway. We didn't want to do that. Mm-hmm. But we couldn't make that decision. It was put to us like, hey, we can't make that decision. You know, mm-hmm. we have to go to the rabbinical, and mm-hmm. then we went to the mm-hmm. rabbis. I think it was Rabbi Zakai here was one of them, or somebody.
Maybe so.
And one mm-hmm. in Israel. Mm-hmm. Richard was the one that sort of made sure we navigated it properly because I didn't know what
to
go to.
That's fascinating.
Yeah, and we got the permission to do it. We never liked it, and it mm-hmm. actually caused us some difficulties later on. Because people who didn't know we had that decree, you know, given to us by the rabbi,
I understand.
You know,
I understand.
They said, "Well, you're desecrating the Shabbat," mm-hmm. so we're not, you know. But we never published it and said anything. Uh-huh. So I just wanted to bring that point up.
So that controversy goes right back to here.
Right.
Goes right back to here.
It's interesting to me. The God promises the Jewish people will never be completely wiped out. That here you have, in order for that to happen, if all of the Jews had been of the pacifist variety, then perhaps they would have, but it would have. But in order for that not to happen, with this Matthew killing or taking the aggressive stance, which violates the Torah, is an interesting dynamic to me.
It is, absolutely.
To keep the Jewish people alive, it's...
Well, it has to do with life, man. When there's life in jeopardized in Judaism, I mean, that has nothing to do with Shabbat. It has to do with life.
Well, what you're saying is right, but it's born here. And it's here.
It's an interesting catch-22, almost. I mean, life.
Right.
I'm not saying life is not valuable.
It's a conflict of values, right?
Yeah, like what's the higher...
I mean, even in our teachings, it's the same way. What do you do nothing on Shabbat if there's a life in jeopardy? Yeah, you do it.
But that... We didn't know that until here.
Yeah.
Right? That controversy way of thinking is born
comes
here.
Up to me. Where were all Levitical and Aaronic priests? Where were they all at when this was going on?
Some of them were in the gymnasium practicing for the Olympic
event. I mean,
that's what we just read.
You had a huge number of priests.
Matityahu was also from a family of priests. He was the priestly leader in the town
the
of Modin.
Levites or Aaron?
He was from Aaron. He was from Aaron.
Man,
so
it's like they're almost leaderless, really.
He becomes the leader, he and his family. So it says in verse 42, then they were joined by a group of Hasidim, that means pietists, which means those who had... Yeah.
So is this where you get the Hasidic Jew?
Yes and no, I'll explain.
Okay.
So in, again, this was... Originally written in Hebrew, then we have it in Greek, then we have it in Coptic.
In Judaism.
But the word means...
Give me a clean answer.
The word means pietist. The word means traditional pietist. And the reference is to those Jews that until now were not taking up arms. Were just accepting God's decree and giving their lives. But now some of them seeing that Matityahu was building an army and developing an ideology that were allowed to and supposed to fight back, so some of them join his army. And they become mighty warriors of Israel, devoted to the Torah. Right? So at the same time, they're devoted to Torah, but they're also warriors. And that combination is new here. It's born right here. It's a new religious ideology. It's an ideology of activism, as opposed to religious ideology of a pacifism. And all those who were fleeing from the persecutions joined them and supported them. They gathered an army and struck down sinners in their wrath and the transgressors of the Torah in their anger, and the survivors fled to the Gentiles for safety. So notice, it's not just about religious freedom. The Maccabees are killing the Hellenizing Jews. It's a civil war. It's a civil war. It's not that the religious traditionalists say, we want the freedom to keep our religion. No, they want the freedom to force all the Jews to keep the religion. It's a civil war. That's why I said that last year we talked about the simple, nice version of Hanukkah. Right? This is the more nuanced version of Hanukkah. Was it civil war between Jew and Jew? Matityahu and his friends went about and tore down the pagan altars. They also forcibly circumcised any uncircumcised boys whom they found in the territory of Israel. They put to flight the arrogant, and the work prospered in their hands. They saved the Torah from the hand of the Gentiles and the king, and did not let the sinners triumph. Now we'll look at the second book of Maccabees, chapter 6. Thus two women who were arrested for having circumcised their children were publicly paraded about the city with their babies hanging at their breasts and then thrown down from the top of the city wall. These are the Jews who weren't actively resisting. They were accepting the decree and they were martyred. Others who had assembled in nearby caves to observe the seventh day in secret, the Sabbath, were betrayed by Philip, one of the Greek leaders, and burned to death. In their respect for the holiness of that day, they refrained from defending themselves. Eleazar, one of the foremost scribes, rabbis, a man advanced in age and of noble appearance, was being forced to open his mouth to eat pork, which of course is forbidden by the Torah. But preferring a glorious death to a life of defilement, he went forward of his own accord to the instrument of torture, spitting out the meat as they should do who have the courage to reject food unlawfully to taste even for love of life. Give up his life. Now notice how the author in verse 19 said glorious death. So this author of the second book of Maccabees is glorifying martyrdom. Right? It's not clear if Matityahu would glorify martyrdom. He would say, no, it's wrong to martyr yourself. Rather, pick up a sword and defend yourself. So the second book of Maccabees seems to be much more in favor of the pacifist ideology, whereas the story of the revolt and the glorification of the revolt, that's in the first book of Maccabees, that book seems to more represent the glorification of this new activist religious ideology. And a good part of the second book of Maccabees is about the glories of martyrdom. I don't want to introduce so much gore and blood into the room, so we won't read the whole thing. But I'll just tell you, without reading it, we have here the famous story of Hannah and her seven sons. And it tells in very deep detail that one after another in the mother's presence, one after another of her sons was scalped, maimed, and fried in her presence. And each of them in their turn refused to eat pork until they're all killed, and she as well. And it takes a whole chapter to tell that story. And the story is told not so much as a lament, but as with great pride. You know, look at what we went through for God's Torah. Mm-hmm. And again, that's representing that religious point of view that it's good to give your life, even for the most minor of transgressions. Eating pork, let's say. Certainly for the Sabbath, certainly for circumcision. So that's basically the set of sources I wanted to show to you. And I just want to take 5 minutes to talk about their significance. So we're talking about four different groups of people. We're talking about the Greeks, we're talking about the Jewish Hellenizers, we're talking about the Jewish Pietists, and we're talking about the Maccabees. Eventually the Maccabees won the war, they established an independent, sovereign Jewish state, and their ideology became the foundation of the development of Judaism for the next 2,000 years. So I brought at the very end here, the last sheet, a little list of the religious conflicts going on here and what we've learned from this. So number one, the lessons of Hanukkah, you have here the triumph of traditionalist religious commitment. And indeed, like you mentioned earlier, had all the Jews agreed to assimilate and accept the new cosmopolitan way of life, there'd be no Judaism today, in theory. And therefore, the holiday of Hanukkah that celebrates all of this is about the possibility and the nobility of maintaining allegiance to traditional ways of doing things, religion, in this case Judaism, even when the whole world seems to be advancing beyond that and moving into newer, more promising, more universal ways of life. But the Jews managed to maintain that tradition. And therefore, in America today, Hanukkah is or should be about allegiance to tradition. It's actually very ironic that in America, Hanukkah is a holiday that's been adopted by assimilated Jews. And even Jews who don't keep the biblical holidays, they keep Hanukkah. Why do they keep Hanukkah? Because they're competing with Christmas, right? They have to make a holiday around Christmas time so their kids don't suffer, as it were. So Hanukkah has become a big holiday in America, commercialized just like Christmas. And
is it big in Israel?
A little bit, because of something I'll say in another 2 minutes. But in any case, Hanukkah is really about a celebration of clinging to tradition and not assimilating or acculturating to the major cultural religion of the time. That's point number one. Point number two, it's a triumph of political self-determination. The Maccabees managed to wrest the sovereignty from the Greek rulers and to establish an independent Jewish state. That's why it becomes such a major holiday in Israel today, because it's a paradigm for activist Zionism, of taking your fate into your own hand and establishing a Jewish state. It goes right back to the Maccabees. And indeed, the earliest Zionist movement saw Hanukkah as the most important holiday, because it was, again, a model for everything that Zionists were doing. And that makes a lot of sense. A third point is, and the last point, that Hanukkah is a triumph
because
of
because it was a non-religious holiday, that's one they wanted to support.
Because,
basically.
I wouldn't say non-religious, but it has within it something that transcends religion. It's politics,
yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. And that's not bad. That's not bad. Politics, the truth is, politics is really can't be separated from religion, at least in Judaism. Mm-hmm. Right? And the last point is the triumph of an activist religious approach. Because, I'll just read what I wrote. First, it's incumbent upon man to struggle against evil. And that wasn't obvious. It wasn't obvious. And many, many Jews, as we read, were willing to accept evil and say, it must be God's will, I'll just give up my life. But Matityahu took Judaism in a new direction. I shouldn't say new, it goes back to the Bible, but it's, it was for his time, it was a new religious direction that you're allowed to, and you even should, take up arms to struggle against evil. Yes, it's forbidden to kill, but it's better to kill than be killed. Better to kill than be killed. That comes from here. And a second part of this new activist approach is that religious text should be interpreted in a broader context of value. Before Matityahu, the Jews were saying, the Torah says don't eat pork, that means don't eat pork, period. The Torah says keep the Sabbath, that means keep the Sabbath. The Torah says circumcise your son, that means circumcise your son. Matityahu said, don't look at it so fundamentalistically, which means so narrowly. The Torah wants the Jewish people to continue. That's even more important than circumcising your son, or more important than keeping the Sabbath, or more important than not eating pork. So Matityahu would say, violate the Sabbath to preserve the Jewish people. And by extension, he also would say, if the situation arose, eat pork to preserve the Jewish people. And indeed, that's the way Judaism developed. In later Judaism, you're allowed to transgress all the mitzvot, and you're commanded to transgress all them, except for three, to save your life. Today we would say that if the Greek ruler comes to you, comes to Hannah and her seven sons and says, eat pork or else I'll fry you alive, what you should do is eat pork and save your life. And that beginning of, again, a broader interpretation that sees a hierarchy of values and is willing to sublimate one value to a higher value, that begins here in the book of Maccabees. So you could say Hanukkah is celebrating all of these values.
Mark, it seems like these, and the thing is, the story here has been repeated throughout the centuries, because you think back through the, say, the Middle Ages, during the different times in Europe where you had the persecutions, and some Jews felt like, well, it's God's will, we're not going to resist. But then you have some that did. All the way through even the Holocaust, where there are a lot of communities, religious communities, that felt like, well, it's God's will, we're not going
to
resist.
Mark, would you have told them to fry your bacon a little crispy?
I don't know, but you know, I see this being repeated, and you still have those same groups.
Let's see something more behind that. I don't know that. Yeah, these are probably eternal issues.
You face the same problems today. It's just enormous, probably even today. The same way. You have the different Jewish beliefs. You know, some are Jews, some aren't Jews. Some are Jews are just name only. You know, they have the Reform that do whatever they want to do. You know, it has no. A little bit different now what it was. You know, I think it's coming around a little bit more than it was. I'm telling you, you know, it's the same way. It's between today, it's here in America now, the assimilation that you have as Jews is a problem. You have people that's in love with this God of materialism, man. They just in love this God of materialism, get some more stuff.
Yes, absolutely. You
know, and they look at everything else. The tradition we even have as Christians in America is under attack. It's not because we're wanting to just, you know, to have the Bible, the New Testament, as our only law in America. We want the same freedoms that everybody else has, same as you do. That's what this country was established by. It's amazing.
And the allure of the cosmopolitan New Age.
And you know yourself, in Israel today, you still have this the old Orthodox, and you have the traditional Jews that are hanging onto this and praying every day, studying Torah, going to yeshivas, doing all this kind of stuff, you know, to know, because that's a real important part of Jewish life, you know, and the other parts of them that don't care, they're busy just doing whatever they want to do, you know, and living like, you know, like the devil, basically.
And even further, in Israel, it's not only the conflict between those who are traditionally maintaining their religion and the secularists, but there's actually two camps among the traditionalists, as we find here. There are those who put all their hope in faith and prayer and study, and there are those who, like the Maccabees, at the same time also take up arms.
Well, it's kind of like today, because now
that's what I'm saying,
to make religious services or service a requirement for even for Orthodox Jews,
army service.
Yeah.
That goes right back to here.
Wow. Yeah. For those of you who don't know, it's been a big issue because they weren't required to be drafted. You know, especially if they were in yeshiva. They're in yeshivas, Orthodox Jews. They had, for the women, I think they had a service thing that they gave them 2 years of civil service, kind of like in museums or, you know, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
But the men themselves were not drafted, am I correct?
That's correct.
Yeah, but they changed, isn't that?
Well, there's a big, big, big controversy and effort to change it.
Yeah.
Has a lot of social ramifications.
Yeah, there's a lot of parallels, because like this universalism culture, which we have today, like they had back then, is Greek, though, or Hellenistic. Today, it's the universalism today that is espoused by the White House and Europe, Western Europe, runs head-on into the state of Israel, because they're saying, well, you shouldn't exist because we believe in universalism. And so that's... You know,
I think that
runs right up. You know, that's a brick wall to them. They just can't stand it.
Right. Europe can't stand the particularism of the Jewish people. It's a generalization, of course. But
yeah, it is.
But there's truth in that.
In France's case.
Say it again?
In France's case, it isn't any assumption. It's just a flat out fact. you know, they just recently, I think was it, they said yesterday, I haven't seen it, but they voted on Palestine, you know, and they were the ones, one of the major powers of the UN, that suggested it or proposed it. So.
Yep.
See, a lot of French Jews are moving back to Israel. They're getting out because they're, a lot of them are coming. You see more and more, I do. Mm-hmm. And the reason they're coming back is they feel that whip of anti-Semitism that's stuck its head up again, which people kind of have kind of hid their head in the sand and said it doesn't exist. Well, it exists. It exists.
Yes, that's...
And that's really, those of you who don't know it, that's why Zion Martin and myself and Rabbi we've heard of one member lacking, but we'll get another one sooner or later. But that was the whole point in creating Jews and Christians United for Israel. What we wanted to do was set a tone, is we wouldn't accept anti-Semitism, period. We won't accept it. So we sort of got off our charter by doing it, but it had to do, I believe, with more Jews wanting to be involved with Christian idea and trying to convince people who don't pay any attention to it today that it's a real problem, and they needed to stand with us, Jews and Christians, you know, to support, you know, any, or to fight against that kind of thing. It's not going to go away. Where we're living in Texas was terrible, man, for years. Mark will tell you that.
Yeah, of course now
it's terrible.
Of course now, I mean, it doesn't. It's just the opposite now. But yeah, the other rest of the world is different.
It's
story.
Like in France, they thought it was the opposite there too. But it's kind of. Yeah. It tends to raise its head up on occasionally over a period of time, and it goes back down for a while. But it all comes down to that, because we've had many emails here from Christians that said, you know, I don't know why you consider, because in my statement, you know, in the book that I wrote, basically in there, and it's always been my profession of faith that we need to apologize to the Jews for what we as Christians did. We've had a lot of issues, Mark and I, over the years. We had to respond to these guys, because some of them said, well, I didn't do anything. I said, well, maybe you didn't personally, but our people that, you know, that were running our institutions, our large mainline denominations, they didn't think there was any problem with it. Still don't. Most people wouldn't believe in a million years that Henry Ford was, you know, terrible. I mean, he was an anti-Semite.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. You know, he walked around with the Bible and went to church every week.
Yes. And do you know who was on the dedication page of the first edition of Hitler's Mein Kampf?
Who? Yeah.
Ford.
Yeah.
See. He praised
See.
Ford.
See. Mm-hmm.
He had a picture of Ford in his office in Berlin.
Yeah, we had one email, Martin and I, about a year or so ago, from the guy from Midwell. I don't live in Texas. I live in Minnesota. I'm a good Baptist. Baptists don't do that. Are you kidding me? They hated everybody. They hated blacks, they hated whites, they hated Jews. They hated anybody that didn't belong to their denomination.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So, you know, it's ignorance in a lot of ways, and that's what we hope to accomplish. That's why we started it. It didn't do it for any other reason. And so, like Rabbi himself and other people, as this gets bigger, as God grows it, we hope, as that happens, we'll be able to go into churches and we'll be able to talk to people about this stuff. There's a lot of mainline denominational churches out there are very anti-Semitic, man. Yeah. Whether you want to agree to it or not, or whether you want to believe it or not, it's a fact. Some of them will discontinue or occasionally. I think it's the Methodists.
Methodists and Presbyterians.
They won't even invest any money in Israel,
yeah,
because to them they think it's
illegal.
You know, they don't pay attention to the Bible about what it says about what God says about it. They're looking at their doctrines and traditions and says, hey, it's illegal, you know. I mean, so we'll take our money out of Israel.
Right, divestment.
Anyway, thank you. Any other questions? Tim, you got any questions?
Yeah, I never realized that split. You know, it was a civil war, too, beyond just, you know, fighting the Greeks.
I didn't know that either.
Yep.
So we learned something today.
Do you celebrate Hanukkah at all? Do you do anything for...
What we do is just light the candle the first night, two candles the second night.
Yeah, they have little schnapps or whatever.
It's not a very big holiday, but it brings up a lot of issues that are relevant to contemporary life. Discussions take place, learning sessions.
Now, how come this hasn't made it into the Maccabees, haven't made it into the Jewish Bible?
They don't believe it's canonized.
Well, one reason is simply the Jewish Bible was closed at the time that this was written.
Okay.
But there might be a second reason, which is not clear. First of all, the second book of the Maccabees glorifies martyrdom, and it could be that later Jewish tradition didn't want to publicize that. Also, just one more thing briefly, is that the Maccabean kingdom actually, after they created political independence, didn't go too well. It degenerated into deposition. Help me with the word? Depotism?
Depredation?
No, I can't say the word.
Degra.
Let's use a different word. It degenerated into infighting and civil war among the Jews for many years. And it's actually, although we gained political independence, that independence didn't look too well. Jews didn't do a good job of ruling themselves.
After Malachi, there is no more Bible. It's all written. It's done. Even our Bible, our New Testament, they don't accept as God. You know, it's a nice book, same as Maccabees to them. It's, they have some good parables and stuff in it, but they don't believe that's from God, you know, because they haven't accepted the fact that Jesus was the Messiah. Plain and simple.
Yeah, so that's how
anything beyond that mm-hmm. book, they have their own teachings and the Talmud and the Mishnah, right back to Rabbi. We have all our own teachings and we have them here.
If this is a deep answer,
don't answer.
But how about Malachi being the last book of the Old Testament? How did the Jews come to this to believe that? Well, like, was there? Did he have a revelation as the author that was different than any other previous authors?
I think if you read it,
there is something in the book of Malachi, we say that he's the last prophet, but it could be interpreted differently. It is a big question, so I'll just say very briefly that for some reason, the Jewish people, when they returned from 70 years of Babylonian exile in about the year 520 before the Common Era and started building the Second Temple, they had a sense that times have changed. That in the past God spoke to human beings, in the past God did miracles, and now it's a new age of history in which we basically have to get by on our own, without miracles, without prophecy. It's the time of human interpretation of Scripture. Exactly like we saw here, deciding should we violate the Sabbath, should we not?
Malachi 4, when you get a chance to read the last chapter, but I'll just quote a couple of things out of it. It says, verse 4:4, remember ye the law of Moses, my servant, which I commanded unto him at Horeb, for all Israel with the statutes and judgments. Behold, I will send you Elijah the prophet before the great and dreadful day of the Lord, and he shall turn the heart of the fathers to the children, and the heart of the children to the fathers, lest I come and smite the earth with a curse. That was it. That was over with. We as Christians accept the fact that when Elijah came, it was in the spirit of Elijah that John the Baptist came. They don't accept that. They're still waiting for Elijah. When Elijah shows up, this is the beginning of end of times. And so those key points, you know, that's always been the point. The problem is, they don't ever read the Tanakh or the first covenant. They don't read it. We don't read it. We're not taught that as Christians in most cases. Now, some of the churches we're in, a little more liberal, not liberal in going back to using the Old Testament in sermons, but some of them don't ever go there. And so they just dismiss all that as, you know, that's all, you know, that was before and doesn't exist today, and here's the New Testament, so no sense looking. And it's not true. He gave us the whole law. We're under grace, we believe. All right? But those Big Ten are still there, man.
The Big Ten.
You ain't getting away with it.
This is kind of off subject, but he mentioned like the end times. What is it? Now, the Jews don't accept Jesus, generally. So what is it that the Jews are looking for now, currently? Is it the second coming of, or not even the second
coming? The first coming of Messiah?
You've got a different Messiah, right? Not necessarily different, but you were looking for something different than Jesus, what he brought, right? So what does the end times look like for the Jews?
Again, complicated stuff, but to make a long story short, you could say that the Jews are not looking for end times at all. They're simply looking to incrementally make the world a better place.
Oh, okay.
In other words, Judaism is very focused on this world.
Right, Rabbi?
Perhaps.
Well,
eventually.
Eventually.
But the point is that Judaism is very focused on this world as it is, with all the physicality, the corporal world, with all the conflicts, making it a little bit better step by step. Yes, that leads up to the Messianic era, but the Messianic era, at least from one Jewish point of view, is nothing more than the gradual completion of the world as it is.
He's going to come when he decides to come. In the meantime, the book of Daniel teaches about it, so it's in the Torah, it's in the Tanakh, it's there. You know, it's in Daniel, really in Daniel. A lot, you know, we believe. All right?
So I'll tell you a 10-second story.
Okay.
I, in my whole life, have never read through the book of Daniel. Am I proud of it? I'm not proud of it. But it's a book in the Bible. I've never read it. It just shows you that Jews have very little connection to end time scenarios. Daniel's the book of the end times. Jews tend not to concern themselves with the far future. They concern themselves with the present, okay, with this world.
Mm. All right. That's good to know.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
You guys probably know more in these last sessions about what Jews believe than most people that spent their whole lifetime as Christians. They ain't got any idea.
That could be.
I'm telling you, I meet them all the time.
You know, another thing too about, you said at the beginning, you know, we taught on it last year, and we're kind of repeating everything. I've read several times, and even recently, from the point of a business, the executive, that the chairman or the CEO, the vision person, must speak a message a minimum of 21 times before the people finally start to get it. So, John, you need to keep.
Oh.
No, but that's the point. Like,
you want to know something? Listen to me. We are right now, I'd be willing to bet you that there's no company or even a group like us there won't be many if there is any other one that actually look for these holidays to have rabbis come and teach us about it.
Oh, this is rare. This is unique.
Well, you know, what we're trying to do is, because we're so associated with it, we're trying to find out what it is our brothers and sisters believe.
Right.
You can't separate us. We have an issue, no question about it. They don't believe what we believe. But that issue can't separate us, because if you go back to what our history is, all right, and we looked at how we've treated the Jews, it's shameful. And the Maccabees, I mean, it's in the Catholic Bible. I mean, Catholicism, honestly, God forgive me, but I'm going to tell you something. They were the biggest persecutors, murderers of Jews. It's been hundreds and hundreds of years they've done that. And most Jews, when they hear about Catholicism or Catholics, they think that's us.
Mm-hmm.
That all Christians believe that. There's, like he talked about, there's a division within Christianity just like any place else. Here we are, fundamentalists that believe we're Zionists. We believe in the literal Bible, in the first, all 66 books. Okay, they don't. So to them, it's like, we don't owe them anything. What are we doing? What are we doing helping them? You know, well, we're more concerned with the humanitarian effort over all of the world, you know. And we say, as believers, you can't do this to Israel. If you do, historically, it's going to destroy our country. Because it's the history of it. You know, it's not because of fear of it. It's just like, you just don't do this. Because we've done it for years and years and years. And every empire that's ever done it, it's gone, man. They're all gone. And we're going to have our shot at it too, because if we don't change in our present way it is, and it's very problematic right now. We've not had any kind of leadership like this in America for a long time. These people in Washington right now are dangerous, man.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the question then I've had a lot of times is, well, why does the Jews support the Democrats? Social issues. They're very socialistic. They're givers. They like helping people. They always want to help the poor and needy. That's the presentation. Now, they're also fearful of us, because as evangelicals, they think at some point we might impose this Christian nation on them and take away their faith, because they've had certainly a long history being killed and chased by us. So there's the fear, man. It's like, what, we have a balance now, okay? And it's good that we have some bad and good on both sides, but if we don't keep that balance, we will get out of hand, the fundamental Christians, and create a Christian nation again. And then their remembrance is, they don't know about all of us Zionists. The All they remember is the persecution and hatred that comes from whatever one group religiously is in charge of another one. That's why I'm telling you, in Israel, they struggle hard, man, to try to keep a balance, and really hard to keep the three of them separate. Even Muslims, man, I mean, they let them build their mosque, typically, unless they start violating some kind of law, and then it turns into a war. In Tel Aviv, right across from the David Intercontinental, there is a mosque. I don't know if you've ever seen it or not. And it had to do when they made peace. When
I think it's Egypt. When
Egypt, they made peace. What was the
in 73?
What was the Sadat?
So Sadat
came and made peace.
And they asked for it.
I think whoever the prime minister was, the prime minister.
It was Begin.
Begin. Yeah.
Yeah.
They had a request because in this mosque. It was, you know, right outside. It's in Tel Aviv, right outside Tel Aviv, or it's in Tel Aviv, right by the shore. These Arabs would go up into the parts of it and shoot at Jews.
Back in 48.
Yeah,
in
48. That was just typical. Let's go up there and kill a Jew. That's what they do. And after, when this whole thing, you know, this war or whatever it was,
of independence,
and when it all happened later on, when Sadat came, I think, or one of them,
I think it was Sadat.
Yeah, came. And they were talking to Begin or somebody at the time. It may have been even Golda Meir. I don't know. But anyway, what happened was they said to him, is there anything we can do for you? He said, well, we'll rebuild this mosque for you. And they did it. They spent all that money, and it's a beautiful mosque. And he said, the only thing we require of it is don't use it to kill us. See, you got to know that Jews have been suffering for years, and this idea that he presented to us today about the three or four different, I never heard one of them. You know, I mean, I learned today something very new, but you have to remember that they suffered for so long that it just became a way of life. And whenever, even today, when I was over in the Friends of Israel, I was over in Pennsylvania, and they brought this Israeli general there that was in the security services and made the presentation to us. They showed how the terrorists, they'd end for him at night. You know, they'd have the drones up there and the helicopters off. And they would follow these guys, and they'd be packed up with explosives or whatever, and they would get in Gaza. They would get in, because when Hamas took over Gaza, and Israel or let them take it back, gave it back to them, they left all these ambulances. So they know the humanitarian attitude of the IDF is to try to protect life first, no matter what it is, even if you lose yours. They go to their extremes like that. They showed these guys at night, you know, they got binoculars, they got all this infrared stuff, and they show them actually these terrorists, you know, all these ambulances in around Hamas is using now to carry these terrorists in, because they know that they won't shoot the missile at the because they got the light on, they're going in some kind of emergency. They think they're going to go pick somebody up for the hospital. They don't know. And they had actual pictures of them all getting in the back with their, you know, with their machine guns and whatever else, and all the explosives, closing the door, turning the lights on, and just taking off. And now the drones pick it up, radar the helicopters, they're off at a distance, because they'd shoot them down if they're close. And they have these missiles on them, but they won't fire the missile. So they get over to wherever they're at, these terrorists get out, go in schools and hospitals and wherever else it is, go in there and then attack the Jews.
Wow.
It's unbelievable, man, of what they do in harm's way, how they go in harm's way to sacrifice their own lives.
And
because they don't want to harm somebody else's life. We're fortunate to have someone that comes and teaches us this, really.
Yeah.
We appreciate very much what you do.
Yeah.
You're welcome.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.